STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Well, welcome to the show, my dear friends. Greg Kokel here, your host of Stand to Reason. Glad to have you on board with me and looking forward to chatting with you, of course. And so many of you know, by the way, that I actually do, in addition to the 2 hours of weekly podcast, which are divided into two chunks, make it a little easier for you, and posted on different days, so we have 1 hour and then one hour, and we additionally have the hashtag STR Ask, roughly half hour that I do with the Enforcer, and that's every week. We also have a weekly video blog, and that's where I look at the camera and I talk about something and deal with some issue in about 4 minutes. And the one that I did recently, you might have seen it. These video blogs are, I guess, sent. You know, it's just kind of like, I think we send it by email if people are part of, they're on the blog on Mondays, okay? Didn't I get a notice? Maybe I did, maybe I didn't. I don't know. Okay. Okay, yeah, so once a month we send an email out. This is how I happen to see my own video. Now I understand how it works. I'm a bit of an idiot here. Fortunately, I got people who aren't. They know how to do all of this stuff. I just follow directions. They say, start talking, and there's a mic, and I start talking, and they do the rest, so, which is good for me because it's not complicated. But monthly we send out a special email, and sometimes we feature the video blog, which goes up once a week on our regular blog site on Monday. And this one was a video blog on Romans chapter 1 and a reflection on the essential or innate problem of rebellion of all people, the human condition. And of course, this would apply to atheists too, and I think they were largely the subject of my blog piece. I watched it and just to review it because it created a little bit of controversy. I'll tell you about that in a moment. And my basic point was that which is known about God is evident to people because God has made it evident within them, because the evidence of God is clearly seen through what has been made, but men suppress the truth in unrighteousness, and therefore they are without excuse. Now, I think just about every word that I just spoke was directly from Scripture. So I am just repeating what I think Paul means, and I think it's pretty straightforward. But it did raise some questions with another Christian apologist who took exception with it in some of his own writing or maybe his own blog, and that was then picked up by Edward Fesser, who is a Roman Catholic Thomistic philosopher, Christian, who has his own blog, and I have his book, which I've enjoyed very much as I've read it, called The Last Superstition, in which he aggressively and effectively, I think, goes after the new atheists. Well, he picked it up and then tossed the idea around a little bit and kind of came down halfway between the two of us, this other Christian blogger and myself, and I think there was a measure of misunderstanding of my point, which I'll get to in just a moment. But this came to my attention through a friend, Frank Turek, who said, hey, you know, they're talking about you over here, and you might want to take a look and possibly answer. So I read the response. Fesser's response was 2,500 words regarding this whole issue, and then there were lots of people who weighed in underneath, and a lot of people were bothered by what I said. And they thought that if you take what I said, which was essentially the root of the problem is human rebellion. So unbelief, particularly with atheistic unbelief, is really an example of suppressing the truth, like, say, holding a beach ball underwater is the illustration I used. Point being that the truth is evident, it's obvious, it's up and available for everyone to see, yet they take that and suppress that. This is what I take Paul to be saying there, and they do it with unrighteous motives, and this makes God angry, and therefore they are without excuse. And I guess the pushback, understandably, from someone who's not a Christian, the two that took exception were, but I mean, the understandable pushback from those who are not a Christian is that, well, look at it, I'm not suppressing the truth. I just don't believe your truth. I think you're wrong, and I'm right. And I do have intellectual integrity. Here are my reasons, etc. And so from where they sit, their own existential awareness, they are treating the facts with integrity, and they are not conscious of any rebellion. Now, some atheists are conscious of rebellion, but they don't seem to be. And so it's like I'm not being nice to them, and I'm maybe accusing them of something that isn't true about them. And this is maybe the concern. This doesn't play well with the atheists. And look, I am concerned, you know this, with the way we speak about these things and communicating fairly. But at the same time, though I don't know an atheist's heart or any particular person who's not a believer, I don't know their heart. God does. And I take Paul's statements in Romans 1 to be an expression of what God's insight is to the circumstance. And I understand that people may not always be consciously aware of rebelling, but it strikes me that what Paul is saying is, at least on a subconscious level, that's at the heart of it, so much so that they're morally culpable. Well, you can watch the video clip for yourself if you want. And I watched it again after reading all of the pushback, thinking, well, maybe I didn't express myself in an even-handed way, or maybe I didn't do a balanced job, or maybe I came out down too hard on atheists, when really the text is broadly speaking about humanity. But when I went back and I watched the piece, I thought, that's not bad. I mean, given the fact that you have 4 minutes or so, and it's a video, and I'm not working from notes or reading from text, I'm making a general point, which I think is Paul's point, to encourage and inform and to educate Christians. It seemed to me that I covered the bases properly. But there were one point that was raised was a potential reductio. Now, a reductio is, if you read the tactics book, is the same as taking the roof off. And that is, okay, Kokel, if we take your view seriously, and we give it a test drive, we see where it leads. It may lead to ridiculous ends. Therefore, something's wrong with the view. That's the tactic. That's the way reductios work. It's a fair thing to bring up. And the way it applies in my piece is that if I am saying that unbelief is an act of rebellion, then when someone like fictitious Emil, a 15-year-old teenager who is a Christian and whose family is massacred, and he begins to doubt God's existence in virtue of that, then the reductio, that is, applying my principle to its logical conclusion in that set of circumstances, would then make poor beleaguered Emil a person I'd have to label as a rebel. It's just sinful rebellion against God that's motivating his doubt at this time. And that just seemed radical, and extreme was the word that was used of my own view, my extreme interpretation of Romans 1. Now, please understand, I did not take umbrage with being critiqued. In fact, I don't recall reading the whole piece, and this is a little bit unusual for me, but I don't recall reading the whole piece ever feeling the least bit defensive. Sometimes I do, but I didn't in this case, and I certainly don't want that to be the driving factor of my response in things like this. I want my response to be principled, not just trying to defend my view, because maybe my view's just wrong. Or maybe it's a little off, or maybe it needs to be adjusted. Okay, it happens occasionally with me, once in a while. Every few years, I get something a little bit wrong, so I know Melinda's not buying that. Okay, I get things wrong, just like anybody else. And so I was not that my complaint wasn't that. I was a little bit surprised at the energy on something that I thought was actually not that controversial, my take on Romans 1. And also kind of the, not only the energy, but he's so extreme. I mean, look, at some people are extreme about things that really matter, but it just, I guess I didn't see the gravity of this, even if I had missed the point a little bit, which I don't think I missed, even after going over it. But what I did do is I wrote a response, and Ed Fesser was very kind to field the response, and I think he posted it on his site. He's a good guy from what I could tell, and I'm glad for the work he's done. And he's a very, very, very sharp thinker. One of his objections was that I made this statement about Romans 1, my view, but I didn't give an argument that I was correct in my view, okay? So that's also going on in the background. Let me just go over the response that I actually sent was posted there and was posted, I guess, today on our blog with the links that go to Fesser's blog and also to the video in case you want to follow that. I actually think it might be interesting on the material itself. That's why I did the video in the first place, the video blog. But it also might be interesting just to follow the discussion, what people took exception with and how I responded to it. I don't know. There might be something there for you. Make it a learning experience. As I've often said, careful thinking about things sometimes is better caught than taught. By trafficking here in my statements, my video, their responses, my response to them, you know, maybe you pick some stuff up along the way. Anyway, here's what I wrote. I said Fesser's concerns, I think, are partly the result of taking general remarks made in a video blog about Romans 1 and asking of them the kind of precision not generally possible in that format. In a brief verbal summary of an issue, there's a little opportunity for me for nuance regarding the kinds of concerns that were brought up in Fesser's piece, a 2,500-word blog, which I thought was very thoughtful. And that could account for my own remarks appearing what some people thought rather glib. Okay. And so here's a couple of thoughts that might add more clarity. I don't think they're going to alleviate all of the disagreement. That's okay with me. I can live with opposing views. And even with people I respect, which would be the case with Fesser. Now, I was faulted for lack of argument. But, to be fair, my purpose was not to make a case for my view, but rather merely to articulate what I took to be Paul's assessment of man's condition. Now, Fesser had pointed out that saying the Bible says so is not a good argument to give someone who doesn't accept the authority of the Bible in the first place, which I agree completely with, and those of you who follow my work know this. I'm not going to say, you know, Bible says it, I believe it, that settles it, with someone who doesn't care about the Bible. But my comments in the video blog were directed to believers, the same as Paul's were, and not to atheists. So in a situation like that, it strikes me that a straightforward appeal to the text is legitimate. I'm going to talk with you about a theological matter. You're a Christian. You believe the Bible. We go to the Bible. All right? So it's going to be a textual argument. Now, as to whether or not my take on Romans 1 was an extreme interpretation, as was suggested by some, not sure if Fesser used those words or not, but, well, all I can do is commend any reader or watcher there to Paul's wording itself. I actually don't think that Paul was the least bit vague or ambiguous, and I don't think he was moderate. Anyway, he said that certain of God's attributes, and here I'm kind of quoting and paraphrasing, but I think you get the gist if you know the passage, Romans 1:18 and following. Certain of God's attributes have been clearly seen, his words, and understood, his word, and certain particulars about God are known, his word, being evident within them, his phrase, since God made it evident to them, his phrase. yet men still suppress, that's the Greek word kateko, which means to hold down and repress. That was what I meant by trying to hold a beach ball down. Something that is obvious, they are repressing, pushing down, okay? That's the meaning of the word, kateko, according to Wiest. And they are suppressing these truths in unrighteousness, Paul's words. Given all that, I think it's difficult to see how a more moderate versus my so-called extreme understanding of the passage could actually be faithful to Paul's words. This is why I was a bit surprised there was a hubbub about this. Further, Aquinas, Fesser pointed out in his piece, saw this statement about knowledge of God to indicate what he called, and I'm quoting, a general and confused, he being Aquinas, Fesser quoting Aquinas, a general and confused knowledge. Now, gee, if our knowledge of God is merely general and confused, as Aquinas suggested, it's hard to see how God can hold us accountable for it. That is, without excuse, is what Paul says in verse 20 there, and making us properly subject to his wrath in verse 18. I mean, if we just don't really quite get it, how is it we are held responsible? And God's going to give it to us because we have a mere general and confused understanding that we suppress. And even after reading Fesser's, I think, well-written critique and those that weighed in to his blog, it still strikes me that regarding man's innate knowledge of God, Paul is saying something quite a bit stronger than that man has, and this is Fesser's contribution, I think, a natural inclination of the weaker and inchoate sort. Close quote. That itself, I think, is weak in the sense that Paul is saying something much stronger than that. Is he not? You read the words yourself. And therefore, people's unbelief is properly culpable. Now, here's a distinction that might be helpful when you're thinking about Romans 1. I did not make this distinction on the video, but I in the future I'm going to try to do that because I think it's helpful if people are picking in this way at the things that I said. And that is, for the record, I personally take the knowledge that Paul is talking about to be what philosophers call dispositional knowledge. And a dispositional knowledge is something that you know even if you're not currently consciously aware of it, which, by the way, is most of what you believe. You all believe scads of things that you're not thinking about at the moment, but these beliefs inform your behavior. I always wondered why people look at the magnificence of the biological realm and attribute it to Mother Nature. Because they don't believe in Mother Nature. They don't believe in a person at all. They believe in time and chance and natural selection and that kind of thing. But why is it they say Mother Nature? Oh, that's just the way we talk. I know it's the way you talk. Why do you talk that way? Doesn't it just seem like there's someone tinkering with things? Doesn't it just kind of look that way? So we invoke a person, even if the mythical Mother Nature, doesn't that suggest something intuitive going on down deep inside of us that we already know? I think so. That's what I mean by dispositional knowledge. We get it deep down inside. Our language reflects it. It's not a current knowledge that is in the mind and currently aware of. And I think Fesser and others were fair to point this out, that atheists aren't aware of believing in God. No, they're not aware of believing in God and suppressing it. It's not occurrent, it is dispositional. So man's state of awareness of God and his heart's disposition towards rebellion against God are both subconscious in people, but they're still real. Thus, though many atheists are not consciously aware of their rebellion, some are, of course, and they also may feel they have intellectual integrity in their atheism, and I think some demonstrate a measure of integrity in their reasoned rejection of God. Still, when the cards are on the table in the final judgment, when man's deepest and truest motives are fully revealed, Jesus talks about this in Luke 12, when man's heart is fully revealed. I think what's we're going to discover, and people will discover about themselves, is rebellion will be at the core, and when it's exposed, they will realize that they knew it all the time. And I think this rebellion at the core is what Paul had in mind in Romans 1. And I will add, I think it's a fairly ordinary, run-of-the-mill biblical point, it seems to me. That's why, again, I was a bit surprised at the response. Now, what about Emil? Poor, beleaguered Emil, who lost his family, fictitious example, like lost his family in the terrible tragedy, and now is wondering, is God really there? Well, I'm inclined to agree with Fesser at this point, who wrote, a religious believer is not like someone trying to hold a beach ball underwater. Rather, he is like someone trying to get a submerged beach ball with a leak in it to come back up to the surface. I think that's well put. It's a different category. Keep in mind, Paul's point in Romans 1 is that fallen humans are in rebellion. Fallen humans are in unbelief. He is making an argument, if you look at the larger scope of the book. He's saying that the so-called heathen are guilty. They know enough to be guilty. The Jews know enough to be guilty. The person with the conscience knows enough to be guilty. Everybody's guilty, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, chapter 3. For the law has shut up all men under sin. That's where Paul's going. Everybody's guilty. That's where he's going here, and I was just focusing in on the first part of it. But for those who have come to Christ, for example, Emil in the illustration, they are not the subject of Paul's concern and therefore not the subject of my concern. Doubt can still crop up for completely different reasons, I think, not because they're in rebellion. So I think the alleged reductio simply does not apply here, since the scope of Paul's comments and my reflections on them is limited to man in rebellion, not to believers who have laid down their arms. It's simply a different set of circumstances. Paul wasn't addressing, I wasn't addressing. Now, however, even deeply distressed Emil and atheists with the same complaint must still account for the objective morality that was violated by the massacre. And I'll tell you, no subjectivistic account, a biological subjectivistic, Darwin, or social subjectivistic, you know, social contract, Hobbes or something, it's not going to be adequate. It's not going to work. Ultimately, even man's ubiquitous everywhere complaint about evil, real evil, in the world, which is a complaint I share, ultimately and irrevocably, I think, points back to the God who alone grounds the goodness necessary to make the problem of evil intelligible to begin with. So if it turned out that Emil was to resist and lose his faith and not believe in God because he's angry about the massacre, well, then I'd say, wait a minute. What was evil about the massacre without God? Isn't it true that even deep down inside of yourself, your anger at the massacre itself is an evidence of the God that you say doesn't exist? And as Paul put it there in Romans 1, he has made it evident within them, something that John Calvin called the sensus divinitatus. Inside we have this as well as the outside. So, it seems to me that my general remarks about Romans 1 and atheists are completely defensible given the video's intended audience and scope, and given the specific language of Romans 1. Now, in the future, I mentioned I will address the dispositional knowledge issue when I address this issue. I'll qualify it that way, and it might alleviate some confusion. But after all, and this is my parting salvo here, though I do not think it helpful to bandy this phrase about in public dialogue, the statement "the fool has said in his heart there is no God" is not mine, but it's God's, all right? There you have it. I'm Greg Kokel. You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
You can connect with STR on social media to keep up to date on all the latest, including articles, videos, events, and giveaways. You'll easily find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, YouTube, Instagram, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians, weigh in by responding to some of the issues of the day, and see what's going on behind the scenes. Social media is your gateway to all the latest from STR, including speaking events, new podcasts, resources, articles, and what's on our mind today. Follow STR online and find all our social media platforms when you visit str.org. Click Get Connected at the top of the page.
It's hard to keep in mind all the facts and arguments you need to address tough topics. That's why STR has developed a series of quick reference guides on same-sex marriage, abortion, and tactics to help refresh your memory and encourage dialogue. These guides give you concise answers, all on a single 8.5x11-inch laminated card. They're a quick and easy way to gain useful knowledge about some of the most important issues facing Christians today. With these tools at your side to guide your thoughts and aid your memory, you'll engage critics with full confidence. You'll be fully equipped to answer objections with grace and clarity. Get your quick reference guides today by visiting the STR store at store.str.org or calling 800-2-REASON.
Greg Kokel back at you here giving you a piece of my mind as I do live show every Tuesday night from 6. No. 4 until 6. You know, for so many years, it was 3 until 6 Monday, Saturday and Sunday. For like, what, 18 years? And then we change it. So I haven't been able to get it ever since we changed off. I got to write it down and put it on the 4 till 6 is the live show. And if you want to call in with your questions or comments, that's the time to do it. Los Angeles time. All right. The number is 855-243-9975, 855-243-9975. And keep in mind, wherever you're listening to the show, in whatever market, you can always get our podcast, which has the complete show, because most markets, I think, only have 1 hour. And even those that have 1 hour, sometimes maybe the local market won't always be there, so you can go to our website or to iTunes, sign up for the podcast, have us delivered to you faithfully every week, and you will never miss a single important show. You won't miss an unimportant one either. You won't miss any shows, important or unimportant. All right, let's go to Luke in Buena Park, California. Luke, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Thank you. Hi, Greg. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thanks.
My question is in regards to free will.
All right.
I wanted to ask your definition, and specifically if it's ultimate self-determination, or if our desires is what causes our choices.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, and it's obvious you've done some thinking about this or some reading. There are two ways one can classically. Now, I'm just going to say up front, I'm not satisfied with these distinctions. I don't think they're broad enough, but I'll offer them to you. There are two ways of defining freedom. One is to define freedom by saying an act is free if and only if you choose it. Now, I think that resonates with a lot of people. If it's my choice, then it's free. If I am aware of personally making the choice and there are no external constraints forcing me to choose this thing, well, that's free, okay? But some have reflected on this and suggested, well, that's not enough. We need another condition, because it could be that you are manipulated in such a way internally that you will feel like it is your choice when, in fact, there was no other option or opportunity that you would have had the power to choose, okay? And if you had no power to choose anything else, even if you were really, that's me completely, I'm making that choice, then it's not free. Instead, there's an additional requirement. And the additional requirement is that you, the classic way of putting it is, coulda, done, otherwise, CDO. So it might be that it's not the case that you could have done otherwise. Maybe you could have only done one thing, but you still wanted to do the one thing. That was the only thing you could do. Some will say that's not adequate for a robust sense of freedom. So you have these two definitions of freedom. I'm just going to call the first definition compatibilist definition, because at least the way this first one is described, that actually is a kind of determinism, but instead of being determined by outside factors, one is determined by internal factors. They're one's own factors in many cases, the desires and wants and whatever of one's own mind or soul, but they are still the things that inexorably determine one's action such that one could not have done otherwise, because one always does what one wants to do. I'm just characterizing the view now. I'm not arguing for or again.
Okay.
And so others will say, no, that's not enough. You have to satisfy the could have done otherwise condition. And the could have done otherwise condition, when present, represents the most robust kind of freedom, and this is called libertarian freedom. Libertarian freedom, okay? So we're not talking theologically now. We're not talking Bible. We're not talking about salvation or Calvinism or Arminianism or anything at this point.
Okay.
We are just trying to get clear on definitions. Now, my own view is I think there are many decisions that I make that are libertarian free decisions. That is, I could have done otherwise, and I had the power to do otherwise. And I do think that there are many decisions that are, in a certain sense, dictated by my own desires. One thing that I'm not comfortable with is I'm not comfortable with saying, though it classically falls into a category of determinism, this view that I called compatibilism is also called soft determinism. Mm-hmm. And I am, that's by way of saying you are determined, but you're free. As long as your definition of freedom is this qualified one. I don't like it because I even though there are things that drive my choices. So I got some ice cream yesterday, and I made a decision about the ice cream, and I have some favorites, and it was 31 flavors. And I actually, my absolute favorite, please don't anybody send me any, but because then I won't like it anymore. And I don't eat it very often because it's not good for me. But my absolute favorite is Jamocha almond fudge, 31 flavors. But when I was in high school, I always ate chocolate almond. So I told the guy, I said, look, that's my favorite. But, you know, just for old tape's sake, I'm going to have chocolate almond. And I had it and enjoyed it. Now, what informed my choice there? Well, my desires informed my choice. Did they dictate my choice? See, I'm not sure if that's really true. Maybe it somewhat dictated my range of choices, and maybe I offered a libertarian decision within the range. I could have gotten one or the other. I could have done otherwise. But compatibilists are going to say, no, no, no. Under that certain set of circumstances, the only thing you would have ever chosen would be the chocolate almond, and that's the one you did choose. But it was your choice, so it was free. And so this is why I think the definitions are a little bit inadequate, because even if I am determined in that way, then my decision is determined, but my actions are not mechanical. I'm still a person ordering the ice cream. And determinism, as I understand it, means there is no freedom of any kind. It's purely mechanical. Everything is happening in virtue of conditions that are prior conditions that are necessary and sufficient for an event to happen. It's all event causation. There's no agency. So I think there is an agency, even agency that is deeply influenced and in some cases may be determined by tastes. Because look, if there was just chocolate almond in there and everything else was like Brussels sprout ice cream, liver ice cream, you know, that kind of stuff, okra ice cream, durian ice cream, no way, I'm not going there. I would never get that.
Yeah.
So my tastes are going to dictate one choice. But, you know, so anyway, that's the playing field for you.
Okay.
So I believe in both. I think where the real discussion is for most people who are Christians is what kind of decision is salvation?
Yeah. And I think Romans 8:7 and 2 Corinthians 2:14 has kind of like been on my mind lately, as far as like the natural person cannot choose God in the sense that, like, we're totally depraved by those two verses. I don't have them in front of me right now, but
if those verses seem to indicate we're totally incapable of making the choice on our own because our own sin nature has driven us in the other direction.
Yeah.
And in that sense, I think I would have to say it is compatibilistically driven us there. That means it is our will, it is our fallenness, and it's irrevocably driven us against God. And I think that is really solid theology. And if I were an Arminian, I would hold that view. The question then is, given our fallenness, then what is it that got to happen? Well, God has to intervene in some fashion, and to what degree does he intervene? Are our natures innately inclined against God and towards rebellion? I think that is obvious in a lot more passages than what you just described. And I think that it's unequivocally so. It isn't like, well, it's a jump ball, you know, it could mean this, it couldn't be that. These verses seem to indicate quite the opposite, you know, and when you read Romans 3, and you read other things like Jesus in John chapter 6 or John chapter 10 and a lot of other passages, you know, it just seems that we're in bad shape, okay, and God has to act. And then the question is, how much does God act? Does God kind of even up the playing field so that we're only talking now with regards to the issue of salvation, okay? Because I think it's possible to be determined in some things, but not in others. So it might be that God makes certain decisions that affect our lives, and that's the way it's going to go. But even though everything is not determined, you see the distinction there, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is a very important distinction. It's not an either or. It's not like total freedom and total determinism. Those are the options. It could be that God decides some things in our lives, and so therefore certain particulars are determined. In fact, look at where we were born and who we were born to. We didn't have any choice about that. These are huge things about our lives that are completely determined by God. However he determines that, you know, I could not have been born of anyone else but Frank and Elizabeth Kokel. You know, I mean, my view of the origin of the soul dictates that. So it just seems, certainly your body, the body you have came from your parents. So some things can be determined. But when it comes to salvation, the question is, how far does God work to counteract the global, universal effects of the fall on the human will? We all start out in rebellion against God. I think that's pretty basic. Then what does God do? Now, a simple way of putting it, and I think this is fairly accurate, is you could say God works to bring us halfway, or he works to bring us all the way. If you say he works to bring us halfway, that means through his prevenient grace, he's kind of canceling out the negative impact on the fall and leaving us kind of half and half, all right? So we are now in a position to make a libertarian free choice for or against Christ. And it's up to us. God has to work to bring us to a point where we can libertarian free choose for or against, okay? That would be one way of expressing the Arminian view. Okay. That holds intact the idea that we're all influenced by the fall and we need God's grace to be saved, but we also have libertarian freedom in making the choice ourselves. We're the ones who are the ultimate deciders of our fate on that view. The Reformed view, Calvinistic view, is that God doesn't go halfway with everybody. He goes all the way with some people.
Yeah, right.
And so, both of them are completely plausible. And the question is, which ones are biblical?
Right.
And on the case of the Reform view, what a Reform person would have to say is that when it comes to the decision to believe in Jesus, this would be a free decision, but in the compatibilist way. Somehow God has reinclined the will, has influenced the will so that the will chooses what it ought to choose, and that is for Christ. It is still the individual making the choice, but
yeah.
it is inevitable in virtue of what God has done.
I
like to say that God woos us. He doesn't force us. He woos us so inexorably that we cannot resist his wooing, and we come to him willingly as a result.
Yeah.
Okay, but that's I think that's more consistent with what the Scripture teaches.
I think so, too. There was one thing I probably just might want to leave this with you and then move on to the next caller, but in regards to the libertarian free will, I know that Jonathan Edwards has done some work in his freedom of the will to argue against that kind of view.
Yeah, he's
saying
not...
that it's like an infinite regression.
Yeah.
So that like you can never get to a point because you're choosing to choose, and like you can infinitely regress.
Right.
That. I'm not sure if you're familiar.
No,
with that.
I'm not familiar. I do know that he was not a libertarian in freedom, but I actually don't see the problem. I think this might be the argument that what I have heard, let's put it this way, is that unless you are determined in some fashion, then you cannot choose. If there's not some prevailing element, force, if you will, prevailing thing that dictates the choice, then there would be no choice. Choice is only possible because something inside the person dictates it. If everything was equal, there would be no choosing. I don't think that's the case, personally, and it actually strikes me now as I think about it just a tad circular in its reasoning, because it seems that an agent by nature is one who can break a tie simply by the force of will. The whole point is that a person can make the decision. That's the point of freedom, is that when everything's a tie, you can just exercise one's will. And if there is no libertarian freedom, well, certainly if everything's equal, then you're at an impasse. You nothing's going to move. But if you have if you are an agent that can make choices, you're able to break any tie like that, because that's the nature of a will in motion, that it's able to initiate causal chains, to put it philosophically, if you will.
Gotcha.
Okay. So I'm not impressed by that argument, and I mean, you don't want to cross swords with Jonathan Edwards. You
know? Yeah, I'm not sure if I represented him correctly either.
Well, yeah, but still, I mean, I think one has to do is reflect on two things. They have to reflect on their internal states, and they have to reflect on what Scripture teaches. And I think we have an undeniable awareness of making choices. And I think our awareness is largely of the libertarian kind. We think we make choices when we could have done otherwise. And it's going to take somebody else to convince us, no, that's not so, because philosophically this, that, and the other thing, you really are determined in the soft determinism compatibilist way to always make the choices you make. Well, that doesn't seem like, from my interior life, that's what's going on. And I think that matters. But when you have biblical references to the contrary, I know that I believed in Jesus and I trusted Christ at a particular point in time, but still the Bible makes it clear that that happened because of something God did in my life. No one can come to Jesus unless the Father draws him. And yeah. Those the Father gives him, he certainly will not cast out but raise up on the last day. Now, I think that's John 6. So now I got to take counsel from that. Say, well, there's something else that was going on. Yeah, okay, well. I was won over, and I do know that. Here I am, an apologist, but I was, and I had all kinds of intellectual objections to the gospel. But I'll tell you, Luke, I can't recall any particular apologetic type argument or answer to my questions that was meaningful in me becoming a Christian. I just slowly realized it was true. So God drew me. That's the way I would say it. I realized, and I didn't get the answers until later. about those things. So anyway, I hope that lays things out for you in an even-handed way, and you can make your own decisions about that. I wasn't really making the case for the Reformed view on the issue of salvation, but at least I've made the two clear.
Yes,
and I am convinced of the Reformed view principally because of the Scriptures.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you.
All right.
And I enjoy your podcast.
Thanks so much, Luke. I'm glad you called. It was nice chatting with you. Let's go to break quickly and back for more on Stand to Reason.
Do you want to become a more equipped Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org, and it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org and click on Subscriptions at the top. From there, you can choose to receive newsletters, updates, and training resources delivered to your inbox for free. You can choose from Greg's Mentoring Letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, STR e-news from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Brett and Alan, and more. They are all loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on Subscriptions, and take advantage of what's waiting for you there.
There's always something new for you on the str.org homepage, where you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on the issues challenging Christians today. Along with new articles each month from Greg, Brett, and Alan, you'll also find new blog posts every day, new podcasts and featured articles each week, a new featured resource each month, and updated news about local and online events. So take a few moments to browse the str.org homepage and see what's new today. And keep coming back to stay informed and encouraged as you grow as a Christian ambassador. Stop by today and every day at str.org.
Demonstrating that Christianity is something worth thinking about, Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason with you 2 hours a week in podcast. And available at str.org and also at iTunes. Just a reminder, four more days. Friday I'll be flying out to Dallas. We got 550 people signed up for that. We're gonna break 600. I know it. And still time for you to sign up. If you'd like to, go to rethinkapologetics.com? Is that right? Rethinkapologetics.com. This is the youth conference in North Dallas let's see what we got here. North Dallas Community Bible Church in Plano, Texas. It's going to be great. All the team from Stand to Reason will be there. Kunkel, Kokel, Schliemann, Barnett, also J. Warner Wallace will be there, and John Stone Street and Frank Turek. It's going to be a fabulous Friday night, all day Saturday. So please check it out. It will make a huge difference in your life. All right? Let's go to Victoria, Texas. Alan, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Thanks, Greg. I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure enough.
All right. So I've been reading a couple books by Sam Storms and Wayne Grudem on the gift of prophecy.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to first in this make a couple clarifying points. First, I wholeheartedly believe in the wisdom model for decision making.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe that you can learn to hear God.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also persuaded by some of their arguments that the New Testament, the gift of prophecy seems to be something a little bit different than what it was in the Old Testament.
Okay, such that the test of a prophet then is not 100% accuracy, right?
Correct, but I think that gift, you wouldn't necessarily, very few people who might experience a couple of those gifts of prophet, like not, you know, for example, like there would be gifts of healings. It's not that you are a healer itself, but in response to prayer, God gives a gift of a healing or something like that, that God would give a revelation.
An incident.
Of some sort, some incident that is completely out of your control.
Sure.
But it is possible that you perhaps could misinterpret it in some way.
Okay. I'm fine with the qualification there, and because I think it's certainly you can have a prophet that somebody, you know, maybe in principle, the office of prophet, I don't think that's still around, but you could have people who consistently speak prophetically in principle, or people who have an occasion of prophetic utterance, okay? The real question, though, is there a way to test the prophet or the prophecy that is biblical, okay? Now, the Old Testament test, and I got Deuteronomy 18 here, I probably have to look around. When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing does not come about or come true, that is the thing which the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. You shall not be afraid of him. That's the one place where this is mentioned. So it's a fairly standard teaching, I think, there's a reason for this, even without the scripture, that if somebody is speaking a word from God, that word needs to be fully accurate, and if it's not accurate, it's not of God. That's the Old Testament standard, and correct me if I'm wrong, the New Testament, the model, according to these gentlemen, is that a prophecy now could be an amalgam of true and false, and you have to sort through the true and false stuff to determine what is legitimate and what isn't.
Well, from what I understand and from what I've been reading from them, is they would say that everything that God speaks and reveals is absolutely, completely accurate. But where the mistake would come in is a immature or headstrong person is just going to say, this is what this means in this moment, in this instance, and they could completely blow it, just like someone with the gift of teaching could say, hey, this is the text, this is exactly what this means, and completely miss the point.
Okay, just for clarification then, I want to sure if I understand this. Let's just say, I'm just trying to think of an illustration. To make that parallel accurate, I think what they'd have to say is, they'd have to say, when God gives a prophecy, thus saith the Lord, and let's just say it's 10 sentences long, that every word of that prophecy has to be precisely and accurately what God actually intended. Now, the prophet then could step aside from it and say, here is my take on what those words mean.
Correct.
And they may not be accurate in their interpretation of what inerrant thing they just spoke, but they still will be speaking inerrantly.
Yes.
Okay, well, if that's what they mean, then I'm not going to differ from them at this particular point. But although I'm very curious to see how that would work out in actual practice. If somebody said, thus saith the Lord, there is going to be an earthquake tomorrow at 12:01 p.m., and the person said, here, my interpretation is that is there's going to be an earthquake in Los Angeles, whatever, at that time. And then the next day, there was some big political upheaval, but the ground didn't shake.
Mm-hmm.
And so somebody wants to say, yeah, he got his interpretation wrong, but he got the prophecy right. Earthquake meant political upheaval, not a geological thing. That, to me, that would be pretty weird.
I would agree with that, and the other thing that I would add in there.
Cult people have done that. Cult people have done that, given a clear prophecy, and then when the prophecy didn't come true the way it looked like, then they reinterpret it in certain ways to try to get out of it.
Yes.
And so this would lend itself to that problem, it seems to me, this approach.
And I would actually, I think if someone were to say, thus saith the Lord, this is what's going to happen, and it did not, then I think there's going to be some serious red flags. Now, most of the people, both Sam Storms and Wayne Grudem, would say, you should not say, thus saith the Lord.
Well, then how is it a word of prophecy, then?
Well, and that's the other thing I was going to mention, is that I think that a lot of times they kind of lump just general revelatory gifts, visions, dreams, a word or things like that, a picture, whatever would come to mind, under this broad category of prophecy.
Well, maybe we ought to be more careful about how we use the word then, and I would think somebody like Grudem, I don't know the other gentleman, but it would be more careful. But I know Grudem has said that, for example, the prophecy from Agabus, which, by the way, in the Acts struck me as a pretty straightforward prophecy. You know, he bound his hands, and he said, the Jews will lead you away. And they said, well, see, the Jews were, he was wrong. He wasn't the Jews, it was the Romans. But this bothers me that he would make this point, because then we'd have to say that Peter himself was wrong in Acts chapter 2 when he said that Jews crucified Jesus. This Jesus whom you crucified, God made him both Lord and Christ. Okay, well, the Jews were responsible for it. They weren't the one who put the nails in his hands. The Romans carried it out, but the Jews were responsible. So there was no inaccuracy in Peter's, and by the same token, no inaccuracy in Agabus's, if we understood the sense of it. It was because of the Jews that he was carried off to Rome, not because of the Romans. And in fact, Paul himself appealed to Caesar. So one could say, well, it was Paul's fault that he was carried off. No, Agabus was right, and so was Peter in Acts chapter 2. Even though, you know, straining at the words the way they do make it look like they misunderstood something. But once you do that, now you got a real problem with Acts 2 and Peter getting it wrong himself.
I find that less, because it seems like there's a specific detail given. He says that they will bind you and deliver you. And that doesn't strike me the same as, you know, where Peter, just to me personally, I don't find that one as winsome. But the other thing, I do think...
Well, Peter says is, you crucified. God made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus who you crucified. That strikes me even more specific than what we see in Agabus. But, you know, anyway, you can make your own decision about that. It just strikes me that this is making a whole lot more of that passage than was intended. And to strain at that, then, and use something like that to overrule a very stable Old Testament principle that we even see, by the way, at the end of in 1 Samuel, after Samuel... It says, none of the words of Samuel fell to the ground. This is the end of the third chapter. Thus he was established as the prophet of Israel. He's fulfilling the requirement there. For that to be overturned, I think you have to have something much more clear and obvious than this equivocal kind of argument from Agabus and things like it.
Which, one of the things I will say to your point also on the Acts passage, I think it's fascinating that there's two different times in Acts 20 and 21 where they come to Paul and they say they're telling him through the Spirit not to go to Jerusalem. Which leaves it to that's the other point that they would bring in, is they'd say, if this was a message from God and all these people are saying, look, don't go, and he goes anyways, it seems like Paul wouldn't, if someone like Isaiah was standing before him saying, thus saith the Lord, do not go to Jerusalem.
Yeah, I get it. But what's interesting is it's not their words. It is, this is the way that Luke is describing it, and Luke is the inspired interpreter. So to say that they're wrong, I don't know. That's another issue. Thank you for bringing it up. Alan, though, good talking to you. Got to run. All done with this hour, and thanks so much for joining me. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week, friends. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.